Hello and welcome back to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by my co-host Chris Snowden. How are you doing, Chris?
Not bad, thanks, Tom. Hello and hello, listeners.
Hello, listeners, and also a big hello to Candice Holdsworth, returning to the show, a writer and broadcaster. How are you doing, Candice?
I'm great. Glad to be back on.
Brilliant. It's great to have you on to talk about a bunch of issues today. We're going to go into many of the nanny state stories that Chris has picked out. But before we did that, I think we'd be remiss not to talk about the big free speech controversy here in the UK over the past week or so, which really revolves around the Telegraph columnist Alison Pearson. She revealed quite explosively last week that she had been visited by the police on Remembrance Sunday. At first, she thought that it was over one of these infamous non-crime hate incidents, that a tweet that she had posted a year ago and then quickly deleted had been written down as one of these Orwellian non-crimes. It now seems to be the case she's actually being investigated for a full-blown inciting racial hatred charge under the Public Order Act. Candice, there's been a lot of discussion about what this means for the state of free speech in general, but what's your take on this particular case, such that we know about it? There's a lot of layers of secrecy in terms of how these things are investigated.
Yes, yes. I find it so fascinating. I mean, this is obviously, you know, something that it's on Spiked. We've been talking about for a really long time, particularly non-crime hate incidents. And those of us who've been involved in the gender critical debate know all about this, just how the police have kind of become the sort of militarized, you know, social workers trying to police people's thoughts and feelings and expression. But I think it took the right moment for a story like this to absolutely explode. And it has with Alison Pearson at this time, when people are so worried about the state of free speech in Britain. What we need to know, though, is we need way more information from Essex Police about exactly who reported this, why it was reported, what they're planning to do to it, and what was said to her when she was visited in Essex on Remembrance Sunday, because we've had a lot of conflicting reports about it. One of the things that I find really concerning, though, is there was an interview on LBC by the Essex Police Crime Commissioner, Roger Hurst, who seemed very blasé about the free speech implications of this case. I mean, he was very bumptious. He was sinister. It was kind of almost foolish. He seemed to think that a journalist being reported for a tweet was merely politically sensitive and, you know, that they should still investigate things no matter what. When you actually look at how many real crimes like burglary and shoplifting and theft the Essex police have solved, it kind of puts it all into stark relief what the police's what their preoccupations are, you know, what they like to solve, what they want to be involved with. And I think what most people would prefer is that they just solve classic crimes and not be policing the tweets of journalists.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's worth saying that over the course of the past couple of days, there seems to have been some reporting about what some of the details might be. Many of these details were not given to Alison Pearson, given the quite Kafka-esque way these things tend to be investigated. But there's someone who's claiming to be the original complainant who said that it was in relation to a tweet that Pearson had posted during the kind of pro-Hamas protests, to be brutally frank, that were going on around November 2023. And that it seems like there was an image of police in Manchester who were posing with some people who were waving the flag of a Pakistani political party, and that she clearly misinterpreted this as them holding up an Islamist or a Hamas flag or something like that, and referred to the police as siding with anti-Semites. The fact that she quickly deleted it would probably suggest that this was something that was pointed out to her and that it was then taken down quite promptly. But it's been interesting how people were latching onto that report as a reason to say, well, this proves that this is a storm in a teacup and the police should be going after it. Isn't the point, Chris, that even if people did disagree with what it is that she said, that surely shouldn't be a police matter?
Well, I mean, given the number of pieces of legislation clamping down on free speech, I suppose you could say it should be a police matter. I mean, anything that's grossly offensive has been a police matter for decades in this country. It's just that that's a bit of a movable feast, and it depends on how the police choose to interpret that, how the courts choose to interpret that, and ultimately the case law on it. And of course, the case law on this gets worse and worse every year as more and more people get prosecuted for these things. So, look, the non-crime element of it, which you're saying is apparently not...
Yes, originally, Pearson alleged that she'd been told it had been reported as it had been put down as a non-crime hate incident. It seems like that was a misunderstanding, that this is actually something under the Public Order Act as essentially a form of incitement to racial hatred is what is being talked about here, which is obviously a lot more serious and significant, not least because it's actually a crime rather than non-crime.
It's a crime rather than a non-crime, yeah. I was surprised to find out recently that non-crime hate incidents is just a term invented by the College of Policing about 10 years ago. I mean, yes, call me old-fashioned, but I think the police should not be getting involved in non-crimes. They should really focus on crimes, which apparently Essex police are not particularly good at doing, looking at some of their crime stats. I'm a bit puzzled, apart from anything else, how you investigate somebody, how you question somebody about something if you're not going to tell them what it is. I mean, what questions were they asking on Remembrance Sunday if they wouldn't explain really what she was being prosecuted for and certainly what tweet they were referring to? It's hard to see how you can really get anywhere in an interrogation if you're not even going to give that information away. So, look, I mean, it would be nice to say that, you know, these things are made up by the police and all the Home Secretary has to do is tell the police to start enforcing the law. But as is usually the case, it's actually ultimately politicians to blame for passing a lot of very badly worded, loose and dangerous and illiberal legislation, which we shouldn't be surprised if people start using badly drafted legislation in an arbitrary and capricious way.
And what do you think, Candice? Is the blame lie with the politicians, the police? Is there enough to go around?
Yeah, I think a few people have said this, because I think Boris Johnson recently wrote about how sinister he found non-crime hate incidents in particular. And everyone said, but while you were Prime Minister, why didn't you do anything about it? Though I do know the two Home Secretaries, Suella Braverman and Priti Patel, tried to do something about it. I think the biggest problem was that they just tried to revise it in some way, tried to reform it, when actually probably that needed to be debated in Parliament and, in my opinion, got rid of altogether, because I don't think that in any way the police should be trying to police conduct or sentiment or anything of that sort. I wonder though how, and this is just me in my non-legal opinion, how Alison Pearson's tweet, if it is the alleged tweet in question that The Guardian mentioned, how that could rise to the level of like incitement or in any way be a public order issue. I mean, it was just simply a mistaken tweet and it was deleted. She probably forgot about it. But I can't believe that things have gotten to this level now where something like that could even be considered by a police force as any form of incitement to racial hatred. I mean, you guys are very knowledgeable, obviously, about the hate crime laws and, you know, how those can be stretched and people should be free to hate, essentially. But I don't understand exactly how this tweet, which was just getting a flag wrong, essentially, rises to the level of public order incitement. I mean, that is totally confusing to me.
It involved the police, presumably. I mean, the picture had the police in it, and I think the police didn't like that. And they thought it was incitement to hate the police or something. But they look after their own in the force, you know.
And they were particularly bruised by that whole period, I think.
Yeah.
See, but that is something quite concerning, isn't it? I mean, you know, like just to make fair comment on something on Twitter, this is the problem with this legislation. And this is the problem, is that it does have that chilling effect where people will be afraid to sort of wade into these debates or even say something about the police. And then we're in a very dangerous moment, I think. And I don't want this to be hyperbole, and I don't want us to pretend that we are living in East Germany and this is a total police state. But I think there is that creep in that direction.
I think we can be fairly hysterical about it, because obviously this is not, you know, this is maybe a more high-profile incident, but there's plenty of examples of, you know, ordinary people, as it were, getting done for non-crime hate incidents and just standard, you know, suppressions of freedom of speech under the various pieces of legislation that have been passed over the decades. And, you know, this is starting to get international attention, mainly thanks to Elon Musk, who is quite rightly pointing out that things are pretty much worse in the UK than in any other so-called liberal democracy. And people are having the police arrive at their door about usually tweets or social media posts or what have you. We saw some very draconian sentences over the course of the protests slash riots just for tweeting things, some of which, you know, I on this podcast, I said, fair enough, yeah, send them to prison. In some cases, they were genuinely insightful. But very often they weren't, you know, and it kind of reminds me of the videos we used to see during COVID from Australia, where Australia seemed to be just the most, you know, off the scale authoritarian state for quite a long period. And there were, you know, Aussie police turning up at people's door just about Facebook posts about the vaccine or about, you know, disapproving of lockdown and lockdown measures. And the rest of the world was largely appalled at Australia. I think the rest of the world is increasingly appalled at the UK. And it's embarrassing for us, apart from anything else.
Yeah, and it does bring, you know, people say we, you know, it's always been that we didn't need those a sort of a constitution with a specific amendment for free speech. It has to be carved out in law. You know, we can just rely on our traditions for it. But I do wonder if maybe you do need that. I mean, free speech isn't some immutable law of the universe. It's something that constantly needs to be fought for and argued for, as we can see.
No, completely. And I think it's one of those things where it was an unfortunate reality that this kind of speech policing had become very entrenched, almost mundane. It's something that many of us have been writing about for so many years now. But it sometimes it does take an outsider or for American Twitter to find out about what's going on, for people to realize how insane this is. The fact that we have had decades of this experiment, not just in the UK, but across Europe, with trying to police hate. The fact that in the UK in particular, the police seem to have been very kind of willing participants in this experiment and seem to have cooked up this idea of non-crime hate incidents, seem to relish their role as like kind of literal PC police because they confuse it with a means to build bridges with minority communities. They seem to think that, you know, your average ethnic minority Brit would rather they were being protected from offence rather than knife crime and burglary. Like they're all of these things put together, but we've become, unfortunately, like the kind of, you know, the proverbial boiled frog used to it, whereas sometimes it does take outsiders to catch wind of what's going on to remind people how insane it is in a liberal democracy for people to be visited by the police over Facebook posts and posts on X and so on.
Yeah, seeing yourself through others, in a way, it can be quite a disconcerting experience. And, you know, you brought up the example of Australia during COVID. And I remember some Australians I know getting highly defensive about it. You know, no, that is not true. You know, Australia is a liberal democracy. But it is true. You can have these instances of authoritarianism in your society and they can occur and they can go under the radar and they can be mundane. But it's important that it's called out.
And while we're on the subject of calling things out, Chris, shall we move to our second topic, which is increasingly a kind of segment on the show, I suppose, where you call out various junk science studies that you've come across.
Largely, we should get a jingle going for it, Tom. We should. Junk science jingle. I'll work on that in the next few weeks.
Please do. If people don't know, the post bag jingle is all Chris is doing, is all his artistry. So do you want to kick us off, Chris, with the first one that was on the front page of The Guardian, I understand, alleging that addiction to junk food costs the UK £268 billion a year. Do you want to unpack this for us?
Yeah, it's a sort of arms race to see who can come up with the biggest figure to persuade the public that they need to allow the government to regulate their diet. So last year, the Tony Blair Institute for Regime Change, or whatever it's called, was commissioned by the makers of Wegovy to produce a cost of obesity figure. There's been lots of cost of obesity figures over the years. They keep going up, not necessarily because obesity is going up, just because they keep using more and more relaxed assumptions and including more and more ridiculous costs that aren't really costs, as anyone sensible would understand them. So the Tony Blair one said £98 billion is the cost of obesity to society, most of which just lost productivity costs from people not being alive and things that are not actually cost to taxpayers. But nevertheless, a nice big figure, which was very quickly rounded up to $100 billion, cited by loads of campaigners. We've seen a few more studies like this, again funded by the people who make Wegovy, which is interesting. So there was one reported in midweek last week by The Times saying that taxpayers pay £270 every year for fat people's benefits. And it's kind of interesting that it's the people at Wegovy doing this, because, I mean, we're big fans of Wegovy on the show, generally speaking. It seems progress, but it is at the moment very expensive. And so in order to kind of justify governments prescribing this stuff, they need to make out that there's an even bigger cost of obesity. So you've got a bit of a Baptist and bootleggers coalition going on, with the pharmaceutical industry having the incentive to exaggerate the cost of obesity to society to justify prescribing the drugs. And then you've got the, you know, old-fashioned Puritans who just want to tax food and so on. And in this particular instance, this new study, the guy's very keen to show that the cost of everybody eating more healthily is lower than the cost of obesity, or the cost of bad diet, actually, or junk food addiction, if you're a Guardian journalist. Because they believe that, wrongly, that healthy eating costs a lot more than eating junk food. So he got together a whole lot of figures. The fact of the matter is nobody has any idea how many cases of chronic disease are actually caused by poor diet, let alone caused exclusively by poor diet. So this guy just makes some really back-of-the-envelope calculations. He just says, well, we reckon 70% of all health and social care spending goes on chronic disease, and we'll assume also that all health-related welfare payments, 70% of all healthcare-related payments, welfare payments, go on chronic disease. So then the question is, how many chronic diseases are caused by bad diet? As I say, nobody's got any idea, let alone this guy who calls himself an ecological economist and a former radio dramatist. So he asks a few people, he asks some experts. Some of them say like 80% of chronic disease is caused in some way by a diet. And some of them said basically none of them, and changing people's diet isn't going to increase or reduce the number of people with chronic diseases, which is probably true. Chronic diseases are overwhelmingly linked to age rather than anything else. And these people are not generally fat or have a diet-related condition. Anyway, but bottom line is no one has any idea. So he basically just picks a number pretty much out of the air. Some study had said that a third of all chronic diseases are linked to metabolic risk. So he goes, well, that'll do me. So that'll be the ones that are now linked to food. And that comes up with an enormous figure of getting on for $100 billion just in and of itself. He then steals $60 billion from the Tony Blair report, which is the human cost of obesity, which is basically just people being ill and dying, but not actually a cost to taxpayers. And then he picks up a study from one of the kind of activist-driven UN agencies who had come up with a figure of, I think, £116 billion being the healthcare costs of obesity. But he seems to think, I think he just misunderstands the report. He thinks that those are lost productivity costs. So he gets this enormous figure, £116 billion being the lost productivity cost due to bad diet specifically. And then he rants on about big food a bit, takes a swipe at Big Pharma and says, well, actually, the conclusion's kind of lame. He kind of just says people should have a right to a healthy diet and maybe we should subsidize healthy food. But basically, you know, it's a big problem. And then the Guardian stick it on the front page, say it's about addiction to junk food, which it isn't. He doesn't even mention junk food, and he certainly doesn't mention addiction. But it's all grist to the mill, isn't it? And I suppose the cumulative effect of all these studies, it's a bit like the £350 million on the side of the bus during Brexit. People can argue about it, and I've just argued about it now. But the impression people get overall is the big figure might not be quite right, but the figure is still going to be big, which it just isn't. You know, none of these studies actually look at the issue properly as a cost-benefit analysis. They just look at the costs. And if you don't look at any of the benefits in terms of savings to the state and in terms of consumer surplus, you're never going to actually know whether these things are a net good or a net bad. But it's just a matter of throwing increasingly big numbers at the wall. I think it'll be only a matter of time before it goes to £1 trillion.
It seems, as you say, an arm race is taking place. What do you make of this story, Candice? What do you think it says about, I suppose, a lot of journalism in this area, that people just seem to repackage whatever press release is sent their way, it seems like?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's really good to dive into this because I think it's become almost received wisdom that obesity, we're in the midst of a public health emergency. I mean, people are just sitting there stuffing their faces with all sorts of unhealthy food. Now they can't work. They're clogging up the hospitals. When actually, I mean, it's true. Most people get sicker as they get older. I mean, I was in hospital in the summer, had meningitis, which was awful. But my ward was mostly older women, you know, who are getting the diseases associated with age. I mean, that is what happens. That is the reality. It's also the case with many cancers, for instance. You know, many people say that processed and red meat is carcinogenic. Actually, a lot of cancer is genetic. I mean, any doctor will tell you that. So yeah, I think we've begun to believe now because we're constantly fed this information about obesity and how much it's costing the taxpayer and fat people are just such a burden on us all. The people have ceased to question it. I don't think there's a lot countering that.
No, not at all. And because we've talked about it so often on the show, Candice, what do you make of the kind of rise of the fat jabs, which have been something which seems to have had a hand in this piece of research or this series of studies? Because it certainly divides opinion, even amongst people that we've had on the show.
Yeah, so I mean, I would say I'm okay with people using it in the short term, just because the doctors I've spoken to who prescribe it say it's absolutely fine. But the problem is when people stop taking the jabs, if they haven't made the lifestyle changes, so they haven't like started exercising or eating healthy, they just put all the weight back on again. So, I mean, I just take a very like practical common sense view to this. If you want to lose weight, if that is your goal and you want to be thinner, whatever, then you actually have to make those changes yourself. If you keep relying on Wegovy or Ozempic or something, you're going to be taking it for life. And I don't know if anyone wants to be medicalized for that long.
Yeah, I should just clarify that this particular piece of research was not actually funded by the makers of Wegovy. The other ones I mentioned were, this is, like I say, this is Baptist and Bootleggers. These are the Baptists. This is a charity slash pressure group set up about 10 years ago, less than that actually, which has the highfalutin name, the Food, Farming and Countryside Commission, which sounds probably deliberately like some kind of government department, but is actually just a yet another nanny state pressure group.
I find it really interesting as well, like this whole move now to make everything organic, everything, you know, any type of processed food or junk food is deemed evil. You see the rise of all the trads trying to cook everything from scratch. And it's so true. Who is behind a lot of this stuff? We actually don't know.
Absolutely. And thank you for that clarification, Chris. I should also say to the Wegovy people, stop funding all this advocacy research and fund this podcast instead. We're amongst your most passionate boosters in this country. But Chris, shall we move on to the final story that you wanted to talk about today, which is, you often talk about how the anti-smoking playbook is just being rolled out to everything. And now there's calls to put cigarette-style warnings on bacon. I understand this is Dale Vince, the environmentalist businessman and Labour donor's bright idea, but do you want to tell us a bit more about it?
Yeah, Dale Vince is becoming a bit of a nuisance, isn't he? I've got a feeling that by the end of this decade, Dale Vince and Ed Miliband are going to be two of the most unpopular people in the country for various different reasons. But I mean, primarily, they're going to be putting up the price of energy and taxing people a lot more. But Dale Vince seems to hold forth on a lot of other issues, which is quite irritating. Look, you know, it's incredibly predictable, people applying tobacco-style regulation to other foods. He's not the first person to say this. And to be fair, if you want to go down the kind of logical extension of these things, bacon apparently does cause cancer. It is classified in the same category as tobacco, I think, by the WHO, because they classify carcinogens in rather an odd way. So it's based on the strength of the evidence rather than the level of risk. So, but it is considered, I think, by them to be proven that processed meats and bacon in particular increase the risk of certain forms of cancer in the same way that tobacco is proven. And I think alcohol's in there as well. So in the sense that they are in this weird classification, they are the same kind of thing. You know, they are both proven carcinogens. I suppose logically it would make sense to put cancer warnings on bacon and sausages and all sorts of other things as well. It's just that it's not – this is a problem with slippery slope. You start doing things – on the basis of the logical extension, the logical next step, as these groups always say, then you end up in a society in which nobody would want to live. And I've got many problems with it, but one of them is just simply how boneheaded and unimaginative it is. Just to look at everything we've done with cigarettes over the years, bearing in mind that the overwhelming majority of the decline in smoking hasn't been down to things like labeling and graphic warnings in plain packaging, most of which have had a negligible effect, if anything, on consumption. Everyone knows it's bad for you. Price and tax probably had an effect. But aside from that, the policies themselves have made really very little difference. And you can see this by looking at the smoking rate in America, which I think is now even lower than it is in the UK, despite having far less legislation of this kind. You know, it's trying to apply the policies that have been used for good or evil against tobacco in a very simplistic way, against a much more complex problem, which is diet. And, you know, the item we were talking about before, trying to even estimate the scale of the problem is incredibly difficult. And trying to do anything about it is even harder. And no country has done anything about it. And I still firmly believe that any affluent and reasonably free country never will make a significant inroad into changing what people eat, because people eat what they want to eat. And people are quite prepared to take certain fairly small risks with their health to enjoy the diet that they enjoy. But it's going to take years and years of stupid ideas like this being at least proposed, if not implemented, before politicians finally work that out.
What do you make of all this, Candice?
Yeah, and I think that the measures used to correct so-called problems in our diets are just increasingly draconian. You know, I feel like the moment we're in is a modern miracle. I mean, the supply of food we get, going to the supermarkets, cheap, affordable, fast food. I mean, I've noticed this since I've had children as well, just how much easier it makes my life in comparison to my grandmother, who probably had a far more unhealthy diet than I have. I have access to a wide variety of foods for me, for my kids. whenever I want them, and I don't have to worry about anything. And I feel like also there's such a huge class component to this sort of stuff. You know, tasty, affordable foods like McDonald's. I mean, they're just utterly demonized. You know, Dale Vince, as you mentioned before, you know, he's even trying to put vegan foods in hospitals. I mean, hospital is already an awful experience. You know, don't deprive people of their treats, of their ice cream. I mean, I saw that for myself when I was there, you know, like people look forward to having a little bit of ice cream with their lunch and their dinner when they're in hospital. I mean, no one wants that. Can you imagine looking forward to like a vegan milkshake when you've been in hospital for 3 weeks? Absolutely not.
No, he also wants to supply more primary schools. He wants schools to be able to serve vegan-only meals, apparently. And as someone pointed out, he already has a company that supplies vegan food to schools. So there's an element of special pleading, dare I say, which is going on with some of this here. Apparently, he's working on, at the moment, a method to extract protein from grass. So he basically wants to feed the nation's children grass, apparently.
But isn't the vegan diet, that, I mean, as far as I know, there are issues with it. I mean, there are actually health issues with it. I mean, you don't get nearly enough dairy and protein from it. I'm sure I'm not wrong about that.
Yeah, that's basically right. You don't have to look at a vegan to see that they're not very healthy.
That is all it takes.
I'm always quite impressed that Morrissey manages to be so fat, given that he is on quite a strict... I don't think he's just vegetarian. I could be wrong. He might just be vegetarian. I mean, you don't see many fat vegans. I will say that about them. But if anything, underweight, which is in actual fact more dangerous than being obese. I mean, good luck to them, whatever they want to do. But Dale Vince can do one if he thinks he's starting forcing veganism of all things on us. This is why he's going to be really unpopular in a few years' time. Once people get to know him more and more and he keeps popping up, he's a blowhard and I wish he would pipe down. But I guess he doesn't need to, and he won't, because he's quite a big Labour donor.
Yes. And I think I think Britain's increasingly becoming out of step with the rest of the world that's backing away from a lot of this stuff, because I think ordinary people are realising the costs. I mean, it used to be that this stuff will make you healthier, it's more affordable, it'll bring your bills down, but I think they've backed away from that now because there's absolutely no way it's going to.
It's all going to fall apart in the next few years. You know, that the target of decarbonising the entire electric grid by 2030 is just such a bonkers thing for any politician who's still going to be around in 2030 to say, let alone someone who's going to be Prime Minister, certainly in 2029, I guess, when they're obviously going to get absolutely nowhere near this. And all the things required to make it happen, heat pumps and electric cars in particular, have gone from being quite unpopular to being really very unpopular as people start having to use them. It's just not going to happen. But again, we're going to go through a period of very destructive policies trying to make it happen before politicians wake up to it.
Yeah. And this just happened in South Africa. I don't know if you know much about their blackout crisis. I mean, they've parked decarbonisation now and they're focusing very pragmatically on energy security. I mean, they just had rolling blackouts until eventually they decided we have coal and we're going to burn it. It was pretty shocking. It's had a huge impact on their economy as well. Massive.
There you go. And it will on any economy, you know, until the technology massively advances. But I'm afraid we have to wait for the technology to advance before we start, you know, doing very, very expensive and inefficient things. And I suppose some people would say, well, the target kind of helps, you know, the innovation. And to some extent, that is true. But I think the trade-offs are all wrong on this.
No, and it does feel like we'll be particularly slow to realise that all of this is a bit of a nonsense, not least because the kind of government we've got. I mean, this green agenda is the closest thing it's got to a sort of economic programme, I guess. And the fact that Keir Starmer was one of the few kind of larger country world leaders to show up at the COP29 circus, I think, is an indication of how seriously they take this stuff.
Really? Are the rest of them not bothering with it anymore?
Yeah, I mean, they tend to only show up like the actual heads of state and the actual prime ministers and so on to like every so often at the COPs, but they seem to be going every year now, which is maybe a bit of an indication of what's going
on. Well, the COP thing has just turned into an outright grift, you know, as of the last one. Well, it is. It's just now just we want climate reparations and stuff. I mean, it's just...
That and the host country is using it as an opportunity to sell oil and gas.
Yeah, he stood up at the beginning of COP saying it was given to us by God.
What was?
Oil and gas.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Fantastic.
It's just, it does seem to be like every year they just show up and they say, yes, of course, we should keep 1.5 alive. Would you like some oil while you're here? Like, that just seems to be the...
Well, it's true. They said they've been doing deals. I mean, obviously, I have no problem with that. But it's so true. Like, I mean, this is sort of, it does remind me of the sort of ancient days of the Catholic Church. You know, you give this pretense of believing in the climate dogmatism while, you know, in private, making the deals that really matter.
Well, long may it continue in terms of this grift being unveiled before us, but we're almost out of time. Before we go though, Candice, we always ask our guests, because we're a very libertarian anti-ban podcast, if you had to have one ban, what would it be?
Oh, I don't know if this is very relevant. So I get loads and loads and loads of scam phone calls, like all the time. Like, I pick up the phone and it's just like gibberish. But I read today that apparently there's I'd love to ban spam phone calls, but I hear that they've actually developed an AI tool now to get rid of them. Where it pretends to be a granny that just goes on and on about her knitting and crocheting and recipes. occupies the scammer for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours.
Can't tell what. That's great idea.
Yeah, I know.
Fight fire with fire. So what, you'll have like a kind of robotic voice saying, you know, something in Chinese to a fake grandmother for all eternity, just as that goes around.
And you could just have the fake bots arguing with each other forever.
If you get on the, what's it called, the telephone preference service or something, I mean, it doesn't block all of them, but if you get your number down, you can just do, just go on their website, put your number in, it blocks a lot of them. It certainly blocks anyone who's like relatively legit. I don't know, a lot of them are completely illegitimate. But if you just want to block general sales calls, it's pretty good for that.
But it's amazing. It's the only phone calls I get because no one makes phone calls anymore. Like, everyone just texts. And so it's like, oh my gosh, someone's calling me.
And then there's a couple of seconds delay and then you're connected. And you know, just that couple of seconds delay is all you need to hang on.
Yeah.
No, I think our generation, like, if someone dares to like knock on your door without planning it beforehand or calling you, like, you hide behind the sofa. You don't want them coming anywhere near.
Instantly suspicious. Definitely banning robocalls. I think we can all get behind that. Candice, Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.